Kansas City Chiefs fans were feeling pretty good at the start of last Sunday's game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. It was cold and rainy, but the stadium lived up to its reputation for being loud, and spirits were high. The Chiefs were coming into this important playoff game at the top of their conference. With 12 wins and just 4 losses for the season, Chiefs fans really felt like this was the team. This could be the year.
13-yard run good for a Kansas City Chiefs!
But as the game continued on, those hopeful feelings started slipping away. And by the end of it all, well, Kansas City fans already know the story.
Final score, Steelers 18, Chiefs 16. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the entire Kansas City Chiefs organization, we thank you for attending tonight's game. And we look forward to seeing you back at Arrowhead this August.
Oh, well, there's always next year. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I know it's not August yet, but before Kansas City forgets about football for a while, we're going to step back and think about the role of the Chiefs in our city. The length of lines in grocery stores metro-wide on Sunday can be reliably predicted based on the Chiefs' schedule, but there was a time when Kansas City existed without the Chiefs. The team has only been here since 1963. Joel Thorman is the editor of a Chiefs blog called Arrowhead Pride, and he's here with us today on KCUR Central Standard. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Have you recovered from what happened over the weekend?
Barely. It wouldn't be a Chiefs playoff game if they didn't take your soul along with it. So I've been there. I'm getting conditioned to it at this point.
Speaking of history, right?
Exactly.
Well, we're also joined by local historian Monroe Dodd. Welcome back, Monroe.
Thank you, Gina, and good morning to you.
Monroe, what are some of the big ways Kansas City has been shaped by the Chiefs?
I think the biggest way is one name of it is civic pride, but it also means entertainment, and it also means kind of a getting together of people, of like-minded folks. That's one thing that a lot of metropolitan areas, most of them in America today, miss, which is something in common. I can remember the Chiefs used to run a bus called the Chiefs Express to the stadium, and I would get on it at the plaza, and we'd ride through all kinds of neighborhoods that I would really rarely drive through. And at each stop, somebody would get on, somebody old or somebody young, and they'd be wearing Chiefs gear, somebody of a different color than me. And it all made me think, wow, yeah, this is kind of a big, broad city, but we're all in a collective sort of thing here. So, yeah, there's some low lows. There often are. But it's interesting how high the highs can be and how, you know, you get a feeling that you otherwise wouldn't have for all these other, you know, your fellow passengers to the grave, as they say.
And it's that you share the lows and the highs together.
Yeah, you're sharing that. As we all know, there's also something primal about it. There's kind of a tribal or a group fixation about that. And there's a dollop of schadenfreude, you know, when the Oakland Raiders lose or the Denver Broncos
lose.
That's
the glee you take in someone else's agony.
Exactly.
Well, you know, give me just the nuts and bolts of at least the early history of the Chiefs. They came to Kansas City from Dallas. They were called the Texans there, right?
That's right. They had been founded in about 1960 was their first season by a guy named Lamar Hunt, who was heir to the fortune of H.L. Hunt, a big oil man. Lamar had been a reserve tight end, which means he didn't play much at SMU. But he had all this money, and he had a great interest in sports. His interest stayed with him the rest of his life in lots of sports. He wanted to get an NFL team for Kansas City in the late 1950s. I mean, for Dallas, excuse me. The owners wouldn't let him have one, so he started his own league along with a guy in Houston named Bud Adams. They and six other owners put together an 8-team league called the American Football League. It was sort of a stepchild to the NFL at the time, a competitor in a way, but it was thought to be, especially by NFL fans, second rate. In 1963, having tried in Dallas and failed because they had another team called the Cowboys, he looked around. Kansas City made overtures to him, and he brought the team here.
Joel, what stands out to you as significant when you think about the early days of the Kansas City Chiefs?
Well, they were really good back then. The first few years, they went to the first Super Bowl and the fourth Super Bowl, which they won, that fourth one, and they haven't won one since. So that's kind of the era that we've been chasing this entire time.
And glory days.
Exactly. We're always chasing the glory days. I am too. You know, but you go to a game today and much of that history is still reflected at Arrowhead. They have the Hall of Honor honoring some of these teams. If you go to a game, you're going to see Bobby Bell out there. Len Dawson will be calling the game. He'll be on your local news. So there were some players from that era when they won. The city doesn't forget those people. You know, if you deliver a championship to this city, like if Andy Reid and the Chiefs had won last week and they were on their way to the Super Bowl, it'd be a matter of time till Andy Reid had a statue out front. We're dying for a winner here, and I think football is so unique in its place throughout history. Like, there's nothing else that gathers 80,000 people into one arena. I mean, an election, maybe that's it.
I'm wondering, I mean, you've mentioned a few of them, but who are some of the big names in Chiefs history?
Yeah, there's a number of Hall of Famers that came from that team. There's one of them that's still with the Chiefs. Emmett Thomas is still a coach. Willie Lanier, Bobby Bell, Len Dawson. I know there's going to be a few people here that I'm missing.
You know, I mean, you're listing these names, and I appreciate the assumption that everyone in Kansas City knows who these people are and what they did.
Len Dawson is about it. That's the one everyone should know. Everyone else, I'll give you a pass on not knowing Bobby Bell or Willie Lanier.
Okay, well, tell us about one of these guys.
The Chiefs had a terrific defense in those first few years. You know, like Monroe was saying, this is when the AFL and the NFL were kind of combining. And, you know, Bobby Bell was this, you know, extremely tall guy, played linebacker, just, you know, really physically imposing. And, you know, for his era, his size and his, you know, ability and speed and quickness, it was, you know, a little unusual. He would definitely be one of the stars in today. He'd be doing the McDonald's commercials and everything like that. You know, and I think, at least for me, given I wasn't alive during that time, my connection with him and some of those players is, you know, what they've done in the community since then. So I don't know Len Dawson the way that Monroe might remember seeing Len Dawson. His, you know, my connection to him is him calling games, you know. So these guys have kind of like stuck around in the community throughout the years, and they kind of affect everyone in a different way, wherever they are, their spot in history.
As a fan yourself and like a really dedicated fan with a blog, does history matter to you? As in, I mean, do your memories of where the team's been and plays that have happened in the past, do those memories make certain moments in the stands more exciting or more heartbreaking for you, as the case may be?
I would say that the thing about the Chiefs is I can go back to any moment in time in my life and I can relate it to a Chiefs game. Like, I know the 92, you know, there was a Super Bowl in between the Bills and the Cowboys, but what I remember from that is my brother had an earache and we had to go to the ER that night, and we saw the doctor through the door looking, watching the game while we're waiting. You know, I remember doing a science fair project when the Chiefs in 1998, Elvis Gerback blew that game and lost to the Broncos. You know, I remember the January 96 loss with the kicker who shall not be named. Like, I remember that I was in fourth grade. I know what I was doing. You know, so you give me a big Chiefs game, and for me, I can go back to that time in my life, and I remember where I was. And there's just not many things like that in my life or in anyone's life that you can, you know, immediately recall like that.
Have moments in your life actually been determined by like the Chiefs' wins or losses or their schedule? I'm thinking of my brother. I mean, his wedding date was selected so that it would be the weekend of a Chiefs home game so that people could go to a Chiefs game together. And then from that, you know, a lot of other things about a wedding are determined by the date. That's a major life moment, and the Chiefs were part of it.
I absolutely have a similar story. I accurately predicted a year in advance what week the Chiefs' bye would be, and got married on that week in October 20th. So I like to give myself a little pat on the back for using my sources to try and figure out which weekend it would probably be. But yeah, there's so many people that have you know, we've even written a article on, you know, how you should plan your fall wedding date based on the best football games. I mean, this is something that, you know, I'm not unique. This happens to a lot of people, and that's kind of why I love football. It's such a part of your life, you know, and a part of everyone's too.
Monroe, I think a lot of people have the kind of personal history with the Chiefs that Joel is describing, but what about the city on the whole? I mean, has football changed the layout of the city, its infrastructure?
Well, sports has definitely changed the commonality of the city, the sense of unity, at least occasionally. Now, I know we're going to another sport, the Royals here, but it's unimaginable to me that a crowd that big that occurred in early November 2015 after the Royals won the World Series could have been brought together for anything else other than maybe widespread panic or something. In fact, back in 1921, when the city dedicated the site of the Liberty Memorial, there are these famous wide view pictures of this huge crowd that had gathered there because the American Legion was in town and World War I was just over. And to me, I used to marvel at that, saying, how did they get that kind of crowd? This was a bigger crowd that gathered for the Royals. And I believe if the Chiefs won the Super Bowl, you'd find an even bigger crowd than that. There's something you can argue about economic benefits and ups and downs and all manner of ESPN and various statistics and stuff. I don't think you can argue the fact that when tens and thousands of people get together for one thing during the Chiefs season, they're paying to get together for one thing. It's a sign that there's something going on there. There's something about group identity and love of the thing.
But is the shape of the city in any way, I mean, reflecting this history of sports and particularly the Chiefs?
Certainly. The Harry S. Truman Sports Complex exists as two stadiums, partly because the Chiefs were here. Major League Baseball promised Kansas City would get another team to replace the one that had been owned by Charles O. Finley, whom the Chiefs couldn't get along with. He was a man of no integrity. They didn't like him. They have two stadiums. Turns out to have been a prescient thing. 50 years later, all the cookie-cutter circular stadiums that were being built by cities at the time to handle two sports have now gone to individual stadiums for each sport. Kansas City was there ahead of it. The stadiums are still beautiful stadiums now that they've been renovated. There's that. I think that Red Fridays, those kind of things, gatherings, people getting together, would not happen without the Chiefs. Yeah, there's college football, and you have these various cabals of Missouri fans and KU fans and K-State fans, but nothing like the Kansas City Chiefs for getting people together and causing, in the case of the sports complex, big things to happen.
What about city politics? Has there been any interplay there historically?
H. Roe Bartle, the mayor of Kansas City, toward the end of his term, was one of the big reasons the Chiefs are here. He made secret overtures to Lamar Hunt. He'd heard that Hunt was losing money in Dallas with his team, the Texans. So he came down and said, you know, as mayor, I've got a $750,000 budget to help pay for some stuff, and I can get stuff through the council. So the city council said, yes, if you guys will come here, we'll give you a lease of $1 a year on Municipal Stadium for the first 2 years. We'll build you a practice facility in the headquarters. And the team came. It was a lot about politics.
Well, so from the very beginning, there's been some interplay there.
Indeed.
Well, this has been really interesting. We'll have to dig deeper into Chiefs history sometime, maybe in August. Monroe Dodd, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
And Joel Thorman, editor of the Arrowhead Pride blog, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Gina.
I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back. About a month ago, KCUR's Question Quest podcast hosted a live taping of the show at the Buffalo Room at the Westport Flea Market. The quest? To unveil the story behind that statue in Brookside, where people have been mysteriously leaving small bird figures. We wanted to know what that was about. Maybe you were able to make it to the event. If so, you know it was a lot of fun. But if you missed it, don't sweat it, because for the rest of today's Central Standard, we bring you this special bonus episode of Question Quest with Suzanne Hogan and Cody Newell. Enjoy.
Where we set out to find landmarks,
oddities,
legends,
and all the curious things in the Midwest that make you wonder, what's up with that?
I'm Cody Newell.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Thank you guys so much for being here tonight. At this live Question Quest event.
So, without further ado, what do you guys say we get into this?
All right. Cool.
Okay. So, the idea for this started with my friend Flannery. She's an artist known locally around Kansas City for this nudie calendar that she puts out every year. She illustrates it. And we grew up together, and we were roommates for a long time, and good friends. And she's the one that first told me about this weird statue. And it's actually down the street from the house that she grew up in, but she didn't even know about it until more recently herself.
There's a statue at like 52nd and Brookside. There's like off the trail, there's a statue, but it's covered in gifted birds, like porcelain birds, plastic birds. She sometimes has, right now she has a lei on. She'll have a crown of flowers. Right now she also has some kind of yarn art on her wrist or something, and mostly birds, though, lots of bird statues.
So, even on Google Map, it's called the Goddess of the Broken Bird Statue. But I like calling her the Bird Lady, and that's kind of how we started to...
It's a better name, the Bird Lady.
Yeah.
Simpler.
So I decided that the best way to go about this was to start looking into the history of the area. And then I also had some people on the ground start, like, spying on the statue over time.
Pulling some private eye.
Yeah. And that was back... That all started back in the summer, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But first, let's back up and do some history of this area. I called... What did I do? Oh, yeah. I called the Parks Department, and there's a historian there, and she turned me on to these articles that were really interesting. So it turns out that statue wasn't always there. It was actually a fountain before that, and it was this fountain, the dolphin and the boy.
A boy and his dolphin.
And it was given to the Neighborhood Association in 1928 by Jesse Clyde Nichols.
J.C.
And Nichols bought this fountain on a trip to Venice, and he gave it to the Countryside Homes Association. And it was just kind of another example of the beautification that he was doing in that area at the time, you know, that gives Mission Hills and Brookside that signature look that it still has today.
You can't do anything in this town without J.C. Nichols being involved.
It comes up all the time when really we do does. Any type of history. but yeah, flash forward a little bit. By the 1930s, you know, Nichols had developed the area into neighborhoods, and he had built the Country Club Plaza, which, you know, was growing in success. And all of those neighborhoods south of Brush Creek were growing in prosperity. And there was also the Country Club trolley line, which ran down what is now Brookside Boulevard. And you can also see here, which is kind of fun, this old footage from the 50s, where it's going down what's now Waldo, you know, over by 75th Street. And
you can actually see some of the tracks that are still left over in that exact area today.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that those tracks not only moved passengers, they moved freight. But so, yeah, the trolley stopped running in 1957. So at some point before 1962, the fountain was removed. And we know this because of a letter that I found from the historian at the Parks Department. It was written by this guy, Mr. John Guild, who lived in the neighborhood. And in this letter, he's asking the Homes Association to do something to replace the fountain that was once there. And he mentions that it had been pretty badly vandalized, and that's why it was taken out. Okay. So I called the Countryside Homes Association, and they have no record of ever replacing the fountain with the statue.
Which is crazy that they didn't have anything at all. Like, all we had to go off of was this letter at first. It's, like, crazy that they wouldn't have any sort of, you know, somebody would have marked it down, you would have thought.
You would have thought that. But they also suggested that I talk to someone who lived in the neighborhood for a long time. I talked to Carol Duncan, and she actually lived in J.C. Nichols' old house on 52nd Street from 1962 to 2002, about. And she seems to remember that it was the transit authority that put it in.
It was placed there by the railway or the transit to beautify that area. Instead of making it a just kind of a blah corner for people standing and waiting for the bus.
So Carol's 87 now, and she even admits her memory is a little bit fuzzy about this. But she says that when she first moved into her house in 1961, I think I said 1962 earlier, sorry, it was 1961, the statue was not there. She does recall at some point going to a ceremony commemorating the statue, but she doesn't remember exactly when that was. The first time we talked, she said she thought maybe it was in the early 2000s, but then the second time we talked, she remembered that her mother had been with her and her mother had passed in 97. So we were trying to kind of narrow down like a timeline here. And she actually kept a diary and remembers writing it in her diary, but she wasn't able to find that entry before this episode. So she does recall going to an event that commemorated the statue, but she doesn't remember the statue having any greater significance.
I don't think they thought a great lot about it. They didn't think, oh, well, Daniel Boone walked through here, we'll put a picture of him. There was no rhyme or reason why they chose this statue.
It's just so crazy to me still, that nobody has any record of this.
Well, and so I reached out to the Kansas City Transit Authority, the KCATA, and they couldn't confirm any of this. They do own the property that surrounds that statue, and they maintain it, you know, doing general upkeep, mowing, removing weeds, and things like that. I went back and looked at the design drawings. This was the time when they were developing the trolley track trail, the trolley trail. And in these drawings, there's no mention of the statue. It's not mentioned there at all. And I thought that this was crazy because this is from 1998, and that started to mess up my whole timeline, too. But then I talked to Ron Guglielmino. Is he here by any chance? Okay.
Oh,
I was hoping he would come.
Ron,
it's okay.
How dare you.
He told me, he used to be in charge of the Transit Authority at that time. He's since retired. And he said that it's not so strange that they wouldn't have been included in those drawings. But he said he went and visited the statue just like earlier this week to kind of get a sense of it, what I was talking about. And he remembered that it had been there before 1994. But he also didn't know where it came from and also seemed to think that that wasn't the type of thing the Transit Authority would have done. So that's not the best gap of timeline there. Sometime between 1961 and 1994, somebody, maybe the Transit Authority, maybe a homes association, put a statue in, but no one has any record of this. And this was driving me crazy for months.
It really was. But then, just this morning, as luck would have it, we got an email from a lady named Margaret Sonnenberg.
That area had become, you know, quite deteriorated, and they were hoping to preserve the area and wanted to work with the neighborhoods and the businesses that were along the route in hopes, I think, possibly of someday, you know, having it become a streetcar again or a trolley car again.
So Margaret told me that the statue was installed either in 1982 or 83, actually as part of a KCATA beautification effort, and the Countryside Homes Association was involved, despite the fact that neither of them could confirm anything about this thing.
And can I just jump in here? I'm just saying.
No, yeah, go ahead.
How crazy it is to me that through all the formal requests that you do, you know, to different people in different positions through the Transit Authority or this or that, like you go through all the formal things and then someone hears a promo on KCUR
right. And
emails us saying, oh, I know where the statue came from
right. The
morning of this event. I mean, it's good timing, but it's kind of like...
Perfect timing, literally hours before we got on this stage. Crazy.
I'm not complaining. I'm just saying.
No, it's great. And what Margaret told me actually made a lot of sense about it being part of the trolley track revitalization, because during that time period, the ATA wasn't interested in light rail, interested in streetcar, never got off the ground, obviously, but they really were kind of thinking about those sorts of things again, so it made sense.
Wait, you told me something earlier, too. Where did it actually come from?
Oh, right. It came from Van Loo's Home and Garden. Apparently is where this statue came from. So we know about the origin of this statue itself, but we still had the central question of why are there birds on this thing?
And so I talked to the Transit Authority, the Parks Department, neighbors, the Neighborhood Association, the Shepherd Center, which is right there, and everybody knew that the statue was there. They didn't know where it had come from.
Right.
But
they weren't hanging around Van Loo's when it got bought, apparently.
And they didn't. And they knew that birds were being left there, but they didn't know why. No one had any idea about it. There are a lot of theories, but no one had a solid answer as to why. Which brings me back to my friend Flannery.
I started going twice a week, and I didn't notice a ton of changes, except there would be these kind of spooky poltergeist things where, like, someone would just sort of move or rearrange the birds, or I would take photos and think that I was seeing a new bird, and someone had... The weirdest thing was that someone would stack the birds or, like, nest the birds so that any bird that was a hollow, I think there might have been ashtrays or planters, would have stacks of other birds inside it, or the birds would be hugging or something. Someone left a paper bag, which feels just lazy. It's not a bird. It's not about a bird. It's a book.
So this is the last day that Flannery went. At this point, what are you thinking, Cody?
I was thinking, one, this seems very odd for Brookside to me, because Brookside is a very, you know, kind of buttoned up, nice place that you know, seems like a lot of people kind of dote over things there, and you don't see this kind of, you know, just random stuff. But also, I kind of thought maybe this was like a pagan thing, or maybe somebody was actually, like, you know, giving some offering to the statue of some sort. I don't know. It was very strange.
And so Flannery, you know, obviously being a person who spent a lot of time taking pictures of the statue, had her own ideas.
Well, my guess is that it's a lot of different people. I think there's a lot of motives. I'd be very surprised if the same person who dumped a bunch of doves was the same person who dumped a bunch of eagles, was the same person who put the pear in there, whatever fruit that was the same person who left this paper bag. And I think one thing I realized is if I caught someone leaving something, I would probably have strong opinions about who it was.
What do you mean?
You know, if it's some teens or something, I'd be like, get away from that statue. But like if it's an old, you know, I have to assume it's just like old women or witches or whatever, you know. And the other thing is I have to assume it happens at night, which makes me think that I should definitely not wonder about, because I've never, ever, ever seen anyone leave anything there, which makes me think it's a nocturnal thing, which makes me think they're asking me not to investigate further.
But we did investigate further. So our producer, Sylvia, who is here tonight, where are you, Sylvia? There she is. She also was documenting this wonderful statue for us. And at first she thought it might have been like a tribute to the Virgin Mary because there are some churches nearby. But then the birds kind of seemed a little bit more personal to her.
I imagine that there was some sad story behind it. Partly because I think it was actually based on having read about this park or this woods in Overland Park where somebody was putting little gnome doors on the trees, and there was a sad story behind that. So I was wondering if there was a sad story behind this.
What was the sad story behind the gnome doors?
I think it was a woman whose child or somebody, like a little child that died, and it was in honor of that child and sort of for the mother to, I think, to feel better. I think that's a story.
That's where my mind went, too. I thought it was a shrine or like some type of remembrance for something.
Yeah, I thought for a child, because it's so childlike and sweet, and the little birds are like little chicks, like they've just hatched out of an egg.
So that story that Sylvia was talking about was about a lady who found these gnome doors, and her child had died of brain cancer, actually, and she had nicknamed her child Little Owl. And she left a note on one of the gnome doors saying, you know, this reminded me of my daughter. Thank you so much. You know, I called her Little Owl. And so the person who was making the gnome doors actually made a little owl on that door for her. And I don't know. I could certainly see the birds being something like that at this point, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, that's where my, like I said, my mind was. I felt like it was some type of altar or shrine, a remembrance of someone. And it kind of got me thinking, as this was going on for such a long time, you know, it's like, how far do I really need to go to catch somebody in the act of leaving, like maybe something really significant or something, engaging in a really spiritual, personal act. You know, like, do I need to install 24-hour cameras to like catch this person doing this? It just felt kind of like, I don't know, not necessary. And
pushing it a little too far.
I started to get really comfortable with the mystery of it all, and just kind of thinking, why can't I just appreciate this and, you know, let it be what it is? And even though Cody and I are in the business of destroying mysteries, I still really like mysteries. And it's kind of like that idea, if you have a really awesome spot that you go to get away from the world, the last thing you're going to do is broadcast that spot to everyone, because you're going to ruin it, and like it loses all of its specialness, I guess. So with all that in mind, I came up with an idea to leave my own bird statue. I made origami paper cranes out of foil, and then I made some out of paper too, and I dipped them in wax to waterproof them. And then my plan was to go and hang them on the statue, and hopefully whoever was doing this would be moved to get in touch with me, and I wrote messages on them to try to, you know, convince whoever was doing this to get in touch.
By far not the craziest thing we've done for one of these quests.
Okay, you're listening to a bonus episode of KCUR's podcast Question Quest, today on Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we have to take a quick break, but the answer is just ahead, so don't go away. Hey, we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we've been listening to a bonus episode of KCUR's Question Quest. It was recorded as part of a live event at the Buffalo Room. When we left off, we were just about to crack the mystery behind a statue in Brookside, where people have been mysteriously leaving gifted birds at the base. Let's get right back to it.
We still had Sylvia out on the scene, and she was still trying to find out more about the birds.
Well, I went for a run that morning, and that was just before daylight savings, so it was like not that early, but still totally dark out. And so, and I had my phone on me, so it was just cool to take the pictures in the dark, and I thought they looked cool. So I posted. I didn't think that somebody was going to say what it was, although I guess I thought maybe I would get some more tips or something like that, or other people would be like, yeah, what is that? Or like, have you ever noticed the birds? But so yeah, I took a picture, and then I posted it because I was thinking of you, Suzanne. Aw.
And then I just ruined it.
Can you guys all read that? I'm loving the suspense right now because people can't read it. No one can read it? Oh, it's a geocache. So, this is Beckett Graham. And Beckett's also here. You guys might also know her. She has her own podcast, History Chicks. You should check it out.
Yeah.
And Beckett and her son, Jet, are the ones who ruined, or I guess you could say solved, our big mystery. Yes, it is a geocache.
Yeah, it's called Put a Bird on It, and in order to claim it, claiming means you have found it or whatever, usually you just open the box, find the logbook. If it's big enough, you add something and take something. This one is very little, but in order to claim it, you have to leave a bird. And it doesn't specify, but you have to leave a bird at the statue to claim it.
Definitely a sweet Portlandia reference going on with this thing.
When Beckett claimed the geocache with her son, it was about 3 years ago, it was their 100th geocache, and it was actually Mother's Day, and it was a pretty memorable experience for the two of them, and they took a picture of it.
Yeah, I remember exactly. And then we thought it was kind of fun, because we even wondered at the time, we're like, you know, if you're not a geocacher, and non-geocachers are called muggles of the geocaching world, so if muggles came across this, my son said, what are they going to think this is?
As a muggle, I fell into that category. And I guess a muggle is a Harry Potter reference. It's what wizards refer to as non-magical people that live among them. So, yeah, we have the answer. It's a geocache. And even when I heard that answer, I thought, oh, it's a geocache. But then the more I thought about it, I realized I don't really know what a geocache is.
So let's talk about geocaches for a second. So I also had no idea what a geocache was. I thought it had something to do with collecting minerals or like mapping geological features of like mountains or something.
Which would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, if people do that, that's totally awesome. But to get a better idea of what geocaching was, I contacted this guy, Chris Ronan, who works for the largest geocaching list service in the world.
The game started in May of 2000. There was a guy named Dave Ulmer who lived in Oregon, and he was a GPS aficionado.
So that is Dave Ulmer. And before the year 2000, you have to realize that GPS in the United States basically was garbage. There was a thing in place called selective availability that the government had put in place because they were afraid that if people got GPS coordinates, they'd be able to pull off like terrorist attacks. But I guess by the year 2000, they felt that they had enough safeguards in place to be able to lift that. And it basically changed a lot of things for people like Dave Ulmer, who were way into GPS, and Bill Clinton actually signed the order that took selective availability down.
And overnight, GPS devices went from being accurate to a couple hundred feet to being accurate to more like 15 to 30 feet.
Wow.
And so there were people that were talking about this on those old bulletin boards that were on the internet, those discussion groups. And there was this guy in Oregon, Dave Ulmer. He decided, I'm going to hide something, and I'm going to post the coordinates on this discussion group and see if people come and find it.
And they did. A lot of people actually came and found it, and the game pretty much exploded from that point. And so people started setting up these caches just kind of all over the place that you could find with a GPS, and nowadays you can use your smartphone to do it. And what people do is they hide these caches. Usually it has some trinkets in it. It also has a logbook, and people just go around finding these things, signing their name in it. And if you have one that has trinkets, you kind of take one, leave one kind of thing. And these things come in all different shapes and sizes. I mean, there are some that are really subtle, like the tree branch one. There's like sometimes there'll be a fake bolt on like metal structures, and that'll be a geocache. It's just kind of insane. And nowadays, there are 3 million geocaches throughout the world on every single continent. And there's even one on the International Space Station. That guy is holding it as he floats. And by the way, Chris Ronan, the geocaching guy, he's actually from Kansas City. He lived in Lenexa, and he got hooked on geocaching while he was here, and he told me that he has found some truly bizarre things.
I went to Brazil earlier this summer, back in June, to find a cache about 3 hours outside of Sao Paulo that was placed as part of a promotion with the Planet of the Apes movie back in 2001. And so it's kind of a rare cache because it's the only one left that's still active that was placed as part of that promotion. And so I am quite certain I never would have done that if not for geocaching.
All to find a geocache themed to Tim Burton's remake of Planet of the Apes. That is amazing.
Well, amazing is one word. That's probably one of the nicer words that I use to describe.
So I actually asked Chris if he had seen the Bird Lady statue, and strangely enough, he had.
I found that cache in, I think it was February of 2014, and I remember, I distinctly remember finding it in the morning and just being like, gosh, this is a wild statue here with all these figurines around. Kind of one of those quintessential geocaching experiences. I never would have seen that statue and seen those birds, all those figurines, if it wasn't for that cache.
So Chris is pretty into geocaching. I mean, enough to like go work for geocaching.com, but he is not even close to some of the people out there who are truly obsessed with this, especially for the top geocacher in Kansas, a lady named Margie Hunter, who goes by the geocaching handle Hockabee.
I don't keep track of them, but it keeps track of them on the caching page, and I know I have over 70,000, but who's counting?
After you hit 70,000, it's just all the same thing.
I haven't worried about that for so long. I know I'm the number one cashier in Kansas, and that's all I care about. Every once in a while, somebody will say, oh, you're number whatever, whatever in the world. And I thought, okay.
So Margie started in 2007. So she has been geocaching for 9 years. So if you divide 70,000 by 9, you get 7,800 caches per year. If you make a daily average of that, that means she gets 21 caches per day. That is crazy. It's even more crazy because she doesn't do that many geocaches in Kansas City anymore. She travels and does these all over the place. So most of the geocaches she's getting are in different countries, different cities. But, so I asked Margie also if she had found Put a Bird on It, and she had. And she actually wasn't that surprised that it stayed under wraps for this long.
You don't want other people to see it who don't understand, because they just pick it up and they think it's cool and they take it home with them, you know?
Right.
So you just kind of keep them in the dark.
Sure.
But a lot of them are placed where, I mean, after you do it for a while, you just know mm-hmm. where the cache will be.
And so I tracked down this listing, even though this cache isn't active anymore. It's been archived on the website, so you can't actually even find it on the geocaching app. And both Margie and Chris said that they're not surprised that a geocache could still be alive after it had been archived. Apparently that happens sometimes, so we decided that we were going to go out to this statue and see it.
See if we could find the cache, and we're going to bring the origami birds as an offering. This happened a couple weeks ago. We went to the statue, brought the origami birds.
And we actually found the remnants of the cache. But we're not going to ruin that for you guys, because there is a little bit of geocaching etiquette that we have to respect.
Yes. You're supposed to leave no trace. There's this whole cash in, trash out thing that once you go and find a geocache to pick up litter. And really the whole point of it is to not ruin the adventure for others. So, yeah, if you want to get into geocaching, you can go try to find it. But I think it's important for people to know about the etiquette and to respect people's mysteries.
All right. You can go find it.
But there's still some mysteries here.
Right.
Because I still stand by that not everybody who's leaving birds there are doing it because it's a geocache.
Right.
And I still stand by that there is someone or some people who are doing things to keep it looking nice, like doing things like raking up leaves and
right.
keeping it, you know, so it doesn't get out of control.
Well, and the KCATA told us they only mow like a couple times a year, so they're probably not the ones that are taking care of this.
They confirmed for me that they're definitely not the ones doing anything with that.
And more birds obviously keep showing up, as we showed. I mean, people keep putting these things around this statue, even if, you know, they might not know about geocaching. And Chris, the geocaching guy again, he thinks that there could have been this kind of bird thing going on before there was even a geocache there in the first place.
I had just assumed that people had already been putting figurines there, and that then somebody placed a geocache at that location. So I don't know, maybe it's a chicken and the egg thing. I don't know if the geocache was first or if people were already putting figurines there beforehand.
We also went as far to try to find the person who started the geocache, and I reached out to him, but I never heard back from him. And so I kind of did a little digging, looked on his profile, and it looked like he was doing this kind of as a hobby with maybe some young relatives or maybe his kids, but had kind of fallen out of the geocaching community, hadn't done it for a while, hadn't been on his profile for a while. So it's very strange. And so our answer to all of this wasn't exactly maybe what you were hoping for, Suzanne. I don't know.
Well, I thought that the audience made when I said it's a geocache is kind of like...
Probably.
It's not that I wanted it to be something bad or sad or witchy. Maybe I did. I don't know.
it just
felt like such this like deflating, like, oh, it's a geocache. I don't know. But I think Flannery put it best. I mean, it's still what it is. It's just 2016. The reason there are birds at the statue is because of like a game that people play online, you know? I mean, if it was 1666, there'd be birds at the statue to like appease a god or something. So I guess it's better that it's geocaching and not like ancestor worship or something. I don't know, but I don't, is it?
So that is our episode.
That's it.
What'd you guys think? So we're not quite done yet. If you have listened to the podcast, you know that at the end of every episode, we do a little trivia to kind of stump each other. But this time, we're going to try and stump you guys.
There are no prizes?
Yeah, so don't expect that. We all ready to do this? Yeah. All right.
There is only one country that the geocaching officials believe does not have a geocache on it. What country is it? A, North Korea. B, Iran. C, Sri Lanka. D, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Seeing a lot of A's.
A lot of A's.
A couple D's. And you can also look at what someone who you think knows.
You can
change it.
It's fine. Cheat.
All right, answer?
It is A.
A.
North Korea. So, next question. Believe it or not, Kansas has the longest active geocache in the world. It was placed shortly after Dave Ulmer's geocache in Oregon in May of 2000. In what city is this geocache? Is it A, Lawrence, B, Topeka, C, Salina, or D, Colby?
No one knows this one. They're saying a lot of different things.
I'm seeing some C's. I'm seeing some A's.
I'd say it's all split pretty evenly between all the letters.
Yeah, it really is. So, the answer is D, Colby.
Cody's dad got it right.
Yeah, dad. So, a little bit of bird trivia. Which of the following birds has the longest wingspan in the world, coming in at 11 feet 6 inches across? Is it A, the Andean condor, B, the bearded vulture, C, the wandering albatross, or D, the golden eagle? All right.
I think the room has ruled out the bearded vulture.
Yeah, the bearded vulture is done. So, the answer is C, the wandering albatross. And as a visual, 11 feet 6 is precisely twice the height of one Cody Newell. So, double me.
It's a big bird.
It's a big bird. It is a huge bird.
Which of these facts are not true about cranes, as in the birds? Cranes can see a fourth primary color. Cranes are a promiscuous species in that they engage in different sexual relationships with different partners depending on the mating season. C, the oldest known crane was a Siberian crane that lived to be 83 years old. Or D, some species of cranes travel up to 500 miles per day while searching for food.
So which one is not true?
Which one is not true?
I'm seeing a mix.
It's a mix.
I see a group of D's.
We've got a group of D's over here. The answer is B. Cranes are monogamous. Did anybody get everything right?
Oh.
Did anybody get them all wrong? My dad.
So that's it. Hope you enjoyed our bonus episode. You can get in touch with us at questionquest@kcur.org. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Cody Newell.
Yeah, and special thanks to Matt Hodapp, Mike Russo, Chris Pruitt, Aaron Pelish, and our producers Brianna O'Higgins and Sylvia Maria Gross for making this all happen. And a special thanks to everyone for coming out to the event and to all of you for listening. And thank you, Cody.
Thank you, Suzanne. Until we meet again.
Yes, until...
Hope you enjoyed our bonus episode of KCUR's Question Quest. And if you have an idea for a quest that you think Cody and Suzanne should still go and explore, you can submit an idea. Just send an email to questionquest@kcur.org. And that's all the time we have for KCUR's Central Standard this morning. But you can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCUR, CST. And listen back to any of our shows online at kcur.org/Central Standard. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tedhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.